You're listening to episode 48 of Our Modern Heritage, the new Home and Family Culture podcast. I'm Jody Chafee. In this episode, I'm talking with Carrie McDonald.
You know, the big world out there outside of our house is scary and uncertain. What can really help is to have this strong foundation that we can absolutely get from family culture.
Okay, the word culture comes from the agricultural term, actually, of digging.
Kids or humans in general, when they are in the right cultural environment to grow up in, establishing the right conditions so what is already there can then grow more.
Are you preparing the path for your children, or are you preparing your children for the path?
Building a family is like building a business. We're just going to say, instead of creating a business culture, we're going to bring that into our homes.
Our vision is like the destination. It's what we want our families to look like. And I think family culture is the vehicle that gets us to that vision.
Giving that initial thought to creating something and then defending it, rather than always playing defense and hoping to kind of fix the broken pieces of our family culture from the ashes, is certainly the ideal. Okay, well, what is our family culture and what is threatening it? You don't. The biggest thing I think of when we talk about topics like this is you can't win a war that you don't even know you're fighting.
Carrie McDonald is an education policy writer and unschooling advocate whose articles have appeared at Forbes, Newsweek, NPR, Education Next, and Natural Mother magazine, among others. She first became interested in alternatives to school while a graduate student in education at Harvard, but it wasn't until she became a mom that homeschooling and self-directed education really resonated. Carrie is the author of the forthcoming book, Unschooled: Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom, being published in early 2019 by Chicago Review Press. Welcome, Carrie.
Hi, Jody. It's great to be here.
So glad you could join me. And I'm excited about this topic because this month I've been focusing on, you know, how we can instill values of liberty and freedom and economic health in our country and in our society, and by starting those values in our home. And so first of all, I just want to start out by asking you, what are your thoughts about family culture and what it is?
Right. Well, I think family really is the foundation of a free and flourishing society. And, you know, each family unit is unique. It's special, which contributes, of course, to this diverse and vibrant society. And each family, whether intentionally or not, and I know you talk about wanting family culture to be intentional, but I think each family, whether intentional or not, cultivates a certain culture, a certain set of values, a worldview, a focus on various traditions or celebrations, a set of folkways, really. And I think that these separate and distinct family cultures then come together in remarkable ways as people interact in the larger society, in our public spaces, through daily commerce, through shared community experiences. But I do think that certainly over the last 50 years, family culture in our country has been weakened as we've relied more heavily on institutions to raise our children, to care for our elderly, and so on.
Interesting. So even up through the elderly generations, like, that impacts our family culture. Well, how would you say, why does it impact our family culture, even expecting that someone else would take care of our senior citizens?
Well, I think it just weakens that family unit. I think the family becomes more disempowered when it becomes easier to rely on external institutions to do the caregiving.
Mm-hmm. So more and more, what I'm hearing you say is that more and more, this is just what is done. It's just what's expected. And that's how our society just functions. We just expect that someone else is going to do the educating, do the raising of our kids, doing the discipline.
That's right. And I think that's... It's interesting to think about if it's a chicken or egg phenomenon, right? Because I'm not entirely certain that it's the parents kind of driving that. I actually think in many ways it's sort of these societal institutions, these coercive institutions that weaken parental influence and power. So I might go that way and say that that's actually the trend. As schooling has, in of course, education and schooling are kind of my area of expertise, as schooling has taken up such a more significant part of children's childhood than it did even when we were in school.
So how have you seen that evolution? Where did it begin?
Well, there was an interesting research study that looked at children's time use over a 20-year period from the early 1980s to the early 2000s. And they found that children's time in school, particularly, it increased at every age level, but it particularly increased for the youngest children ages 6 to 8, were spending 2 hours more in school each week during that 20-year period. But it increased at all age levels. And that didn't include after-school time. That was just kind of your standard day. So if you add in after-school activities or after-school care, as well as these other kind of adult-structured school-like activities, children are spending more and more time in school and less time with their families, less time in their neighborhoods. I mean, we've seen free play in our neighborhood completely evaporate. One of my colleagues at the Alliance for Self-Directed Education is Boston College psychology professor Peter Gray, who argues for really a causal relationship in the decline of children's play and the rise of childhood mental health disorders.
I can definitely agree with that. And, you know, I live in a cul-de-sac and I send my kids outside almost every day. And we actually have almost every house on our cul-de-sac has kids around my kids' age, which people would go, wow, that's amazing. You know, it's such a blessing.
Right.
But none of them are out there.
That's
almost
right.
Almost never. And it's tragic that I'll be like, you know, they want to go out and see their friends. They want to see the kids in the neighborhood and they're just not there.
Well, I mean, and there's data to back that up. If you look at, there was some data from July of 2016 showed that I think it was 42% of children were in school in July of 2016 compared to 10% in 1985. So it's not just your imagination. I mean, you know, if they're not in school or a school-like activity, they're in a structured camp, which, you know, for all intents and purposes acts like school all year. So play in just one generation, children's play, children's free opportunities in their neighborhoods have dramatically declined.
So that's a big challenge, though, because I think people feel like they have to do these things because it's our culture at large that's kind of driving this perception and expectation that that's what we're supposed to do. So what counsel or advice did you give to parents who want to know how to kind of break away from that or how to learn what it takes to break away from that?
Well, I think the first piece really is just an awareness that if you have the ability to kind of avoid the trend of making sure that every minute of your children's life is scheduled, to recognize the value of unstructured time, of free time for your children, particularly in light of the fact that they spend so much more time in school and school-like settings during the academic year than ever before. I think part of it is just sort of enlightenment, just education that it's good for your children to have downtime, to have free time, that is a great quality for their physical, mental, and emotional well-being. And then I think the other thing is the rise of the gig economy. I think that, you know, as more and more of our economy is focused on freelance work or gig work, independent contract work, that creates really a lot of opportunities for a lot of families and hopefully will continue to offer more and more opportunities to families to be able to share work, to be able to work from home more, to be able to have flexible schedules so that their kids don't have to be in these structured adult-led activities all the time.
Interesting. So a couple of thoughts that I had while you were talking were that when you transition to allowing your children to have more free play, there is a learning curve there, would you say? I think some parents, they tense up and they go, I don't know about that, letting my kid do whatever they want or, you know, things like that. But how crucial it is for them that they learn how to self-direct, how to choose for themselves and start to discover themselves. And that relates to this idea of the gig economy, not only in that our parents are allowed to have more freedom, they're getting more freedom, more ability, stability of, you know, choosing, but also that our kids are being raised in that economy where they need to have the capacity to figure out what they want.
Right. Well, I mean, that's sort of the interesting contrast, right? Is that as adults, we're getting hopefully more and more freedom. And certainly the trend in the gig economy is showing that we're sort of having the opposite effect on our children and placing them in more restrictive environments for more of their day and more of their year. And I think that part of it is hopefully to trickle down to say, you know, as we grownups appreciate freedom in our lives and in our work, that we can share that same freedom, grant that same freedom to our children.
And I think that's where the family culture idea comes in. If if parents value that freedom and they value, you know, because what I love about the gig economy idea and freelance work and things like that is that you can find any creative outlet that is your authentic expression. And when you value that ability of and that fulfillment of living that kind of a lifestyle, that's what you want to translate down to your kids going, no, I want you to be able to express yourself. I want you to be able to explore your capacity, because anymore, you don't have to grow up and go to all the Ivy League schools in order to be super ultra successful. You know, you can grow up and whatever your creative expression is, you can find a career in that, which is right. Amazing, right? That's, we live in a really miraculous and blessed time that we have that ability to do that.
Right. And I think part of that, kind of instilling that freedom in our children is also sharing with them, you know, kind of what this entrepreneurial ethos is. I mean, I think part of the sort of the heart of the gig economy is really an entrepreneurial mindset. And so it's encouraging our children to be more entrepreneurial. And part of that is being creative, thinking about what they're passionate about. And then, is there a market for that? Is there a demand for that? How do I make my product or service better? And of course, you know, it used to be we'd have lemonade stands, or we would, you know, go around with our flyer saying that we could mow neighbors' lawns or shovel their driveways. And now when kids are spending so much of their time in these structured adult-led activities, there aren't those opportunities for sort of entrepreneurial mindset and expression.
Yeah, because it's a total trial and error process. I think that when you have that freedom and you're able to explore, you gain that ability to take risks.
Right.
That's so huge. And kids are not, when they're in this, they're in school all day, risk and failure are constantly frowned upon, you know? Right. And when kids start to express interest in that type of entrepreneurial type of attitude, parents go, whoa, we stop right there.
Right.
And it's scary. We're afraid.
Right.
And how do we combat that attitude and that fear?
Well, I think the beginning piece is just to recognize, you know, again, where we are as a society, where we are as an economy, that this is sort of the future, is being creative and being entrepreneurial, particularly as robots are going to take over more and more of the jobs that humans are now doing. We need to differentiate ourselves as humans from artificial intelligence. And these qualities of creativity and ingenuity and inventiveness and entrepreneurialism, those are the characteristics that truly distinguish humans from robots. And so that's exactly what we want to be cultivating in our children.
That creativity, that self-expression. I love that. What kinds of activities will help parents encourage their families to be more adaptive and more creative?
Yeah, I think it starts by valuing this idea of downtime and of unstructured time. And I think it's tricky because, as some parents might see when their kids are at home in the afternoon, if they have a free afternoon, or on the weekends or during summer vacation, they might say, oh, all my kid does is play video games. And that might be deflating for them. They might say, see, you know, when I give them free time, this is what they do. And my response to that is to say that often when kids are gravitating to video games or social media, Snapchat, those kinds of things, it's because so much of their life is programmed, is controlled by others, that it's often their only moment to have some autonomy, to have some command of their life. And in a video game world, they have full command of an entire world. It's sort of the equivalent of those of us playing, you know, hide and go seek in our neighborhood when we were little. It's the virtual modern equivalent to that, because as you've said, the kids have disappeared from neighborhoods. So I think the first thing is to sort of acknowledge that kids are often gravitating in what we might say sort of an addictive fashion to technology or to video games because they are overly scheduled and overly programmed. And so the response to that is not necessarily to forbid the technology, but to provide more freedom and opportunity for them. It's to get to the root cause and give them more autonomy, give them more opportunity, give them more freedom in the rest of their lives. And then if that's the case, video games don't become that sort of lifeboat at the end of a stressful day. I mean, just like some of us might sit and watch TV at the end of a long day, you just kind of want to veg out because you've been stimulated so much all day. And I think that's the same thing now with kids who are so much of their day and their week is consumed by adult-led structured activities.
Wow, that's a really profound idea that give them more time. I think it's hard. It's our default that we want to go, no more electronics, no more video games. And all that's doing is taking away more of that autonomy that they want so badly. And so the solution is to just give them more of that freedom, more of that time. And it's interesting that you brought up the idea of, you know, that consuming and versus being productive and things. And all right, now I have this 30-day coping strategy challenge campaign that I'm going through. And, you know, a lot of the things that I've brought up are about how, you know, our coping strategies so often are avoidance and escape strategies. And that, you know, that going to our electronics and our devices, it is like the epitome of this escape idea. And like you said, it's the only way that we feel or one of the few ways that we kind of feel like we're in control of our lives. And a lot of times, a lot of these other escape mechanisms help us feel like we have that sense of control.
Right.
But what you're saying is that having more free time, unstructured time, less time of people telling you what to do is the way to have that freedom and to cope with feeling restricted by having the freedom.
And I would say though that it's freedom and it's opportunity. So interestingly, I can share an anecdote from my forthcoming book about unschooling, which talks about a summer camp program, a self-directed summer camp program called Camp Stomping Ground in upstate New York that sort of runs on these unschooling principles, this idea of freedom and autonomy and self-direction. And Jack Schott and Laura Kriegel are the camp founders and directors. And when I interviewed them, they said, you know, restrictions on technology. It's really this sort of freedom entirely. I think they're slightly remote, so they might have some internet connection issues, but certainly kids would be able to play video games and all of those other things. And so I said to them, well, don't kids just spend the entire week playing video games if they have no limits? Because many of these kids, you know, again, go to conventional schooling during the year. So this is their 1 week where they have this like true freedom. Mm-hmm. And they said that often it's the parents will come, and that's when they're deciding whether or not to send their kids to this camp. And they'll say, you know, I'm really worried that they're just going to spend their whole week on technology because it's our biggest pain point during the year. All they do when they're not in school is play Minecraft, or they're always on their computers, or always on screens. And what the camp directors find is that's not the case, that they may start off in that first day glued to their screen, but then they'll see a big shaving cream fight outside on the green. And who doesn't want to be a part of that? Like, so it's also opportunity. It's also being, you know, making sure that you know, maybe you're not doing shaving cream fights in your backyard, but that you're maybe, you know, taking your child to the library or the museum, or if they're old enough, allowing them to go there on their own. You know, exposing them to sort of community resources and providing opportunities that make screens less appealing, but still cultivate that freedom and that autonomy for them. So I think there is that combination of freedom and opportunity.
That's a really awesome point. I think that's you're spot on with that whole idea of creating an alternate idea. You know, it's like, it's not just, okay, go ahead, go off and do whatever. It's okay, go off and do stuff, but here are all of your options. Yeah. are all your choices that you can do that.
That's right. And it's a little bit harder now, again, when there's not the kids in the neighborhood, right? But it requires a bit more parental forethought than it did when we were kids, because when we were kids, we could just go off and find some group of friends to play catch with, or, you know, to do street hockey with or so on. And that's a little bit harder. So it does require, I think, parents to be a bit more involved in thinking about providing these opportunities that might not organically already exist. But there's a difference between providing opportunity and creating structured activities. And I think that's the real distinction, right? Uh-huh. That we still want to provide kids with opportunities for this unstructured freedom and play that isn't adult controlled.
Mm. Especially if it's new, if this is a whole new concept. You know, right now, my little kids, we've been living like this probably for a while, where I'm like, you know, just go, do something.
Yeah.
And they could sit and play for hours with Legos or something like that. But that's because they've adjusted to that attitude where I'm going, just pick something and do it. Yeah. So there's that transition period that eventually your kids are going to start catching on, going, oh, I want to do this and that and the other thing that I want to do, because it's like a muscle to like learn how to figure out what is appealing.
It's completely true. And again, when we were kids, we were just, that was what it was like. It was our kind of our natural muscle, right? Is that free play was the default, and now it's the opposite. And so I think, yes, we absolutely have to cultivate that in our homes and our communities and provide the time and space and opportunity for kids to freely play.
Yeah. You're speaking my language here. That's what family culture is about, right? It's all about having that, being intentional, having a vision of what you want to accomplish and being proactive about it. So that, you know, that's, you are cultivating. It's like a garden that you're growing, and you need to cultivate that garden.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So explain to me a little bit more about what your views about unschool are briefly, because I homeschool my kids, and we are a little bit unschooled because we try to establish a good environment and provide activities where the kids can, you know, we go to the library, like you were saying, or, you know, we go to the pool, sometimes I'll sign them up for like a sporting activity or something like that. But I think some people interpret or think when they hear unschool, they're going, wait, you don't teach your kids anything? So what is your take on unschool and what that means?
Right. So unschooling is an approach to homeschooling and a philosophy of education more broadly known as self-directed education that really focuses on separating schooling from education is sort of its fundamental premise. So if we think about conventional school and conventional homeschooling, they operate under a schooling model of an adult knows information that they will then pass along in an orderly, systematic, and coercive fashion to children who don't know anything. It's this sort of top-down instructional approach, whether that's in school or in a school at home homeschooling environment. Unschooling dismisses that whole idea, challenges that whole school mindset, and basically says that education is separate from schooling, that learning can be self-directed, it can be focused around children's interests and emerging passions, and from that experience, there'll be a tremendous amount of learning that will come from that. So for example, kids will learn to read when they are allowed access to books, and again, parents are providing access, connecting those resources with those interests. But they will learn to read when they're reading things that matter to them, that are interesting to them, as opposed to, you know, maybe not all kids like Dick and Jane or the Bob books or even sort of this conventional curriculum for reading. But a kid that loves dinosaurs and then is provided with lots of opportunities to read books about dinosaurs, have books about dinosaurs read to him or her, go to the library, and all of these other things, they will learn to read through that passion. And then they'll learn to read really strongly. They'll become strong readers because it's tied to that passion, to those interests. So that's just one example. And, you know, I can give you sort of a recent example. I have four children. They're 11, 9, 7, and 4. They've never been to school, always been unschooled. And I'll share just briefly, my older daughter, who's 11, got into martial arts about 9 months ago now. And she, in one of our neighborhood walks, there was a new martial arts studio opening. She was really curious and wanted to go in and talk to the instructors and find out about it. And she was hooked. And she's been loving doing her martial arts several times a week. And then recently, she became interested in the Korean language and Korean culture, which, of course, is where this martial arts line came from. So she's been taking classes that she's been seeking out. So we started with Duolingo, which is just a free online foreign language learning program. She started with that and really loved it and then wanted more. And so we've been able to connect her to some more classes. So unschooling is not sort of anti-academic. It's just that it's a different pathway to academics that's really focused on children's interests, but can often lead to very rigorous, demanding learning, often tied to a curriculum. In fact, she's now wanted to buy, or she has bought, we've bought for her, a Korean curriculum that she found through one of these classes that she's been taking. So we have a Korean textbook. A Korean language textbook in our home. So unschooling is not anti-curriculum or anti-academic. It's just that it's the children's interests and passions that are leading that process, as opposed to me saying, okay, this year we're going to learn Korean. This is the textbook we're going to use. These are the times of the day and the week that we're going to do this. These are the assessments we're going to look for. So it kind of flips the whole schooling model on its head.
Yeah. As I was listening to you, I was reviewing all these things that I've been listening to, a book, How to Raise an Adult. And it's like everything that you just talked about is exactly what's wrong. You know, that nobody thinks this way anymore, that kids are constantly being told what to do, what to think, what direction to go in. And then by the time they become adults, they have no idea what to do. They don't even know how to take care of themselves even. Right. But this idea that you're allowing them that freedom to lead their own education, they are actually learning really important skills about how to prepare for adulthood, prepare for life.
That's right.
So that's a really
and again, it's not them doing it on their own. There's a tremendously important adult role, whether that's a homeschooling parent in the home or in one of these self-directed learning centers that's opening, they're sprouting across the country, where there's adult facilitators doing the same thing. Connecting, recognizing and then connecting children's interests to available opportunities and resources, both in the community around them and virtual resources. I mean, that's the one thing I sort of feel like schooling, conventional schooling, is becoming more and more obsolete as we have information at our fingertips, that we all become self-directed learners. I mean, I often wonder, like, what all these questions that my kids have and that I have are now just literally a click away of finding the answer. So we have all this information, this opportunity to self-direct our learning, to self-educate, that we just didn't have before. You know, historically, you went to school and learned from teachers because that was where the books and knowledge were.
Right.
And now the books and knowledge are accessible to all of us. So I think this is just the pathway forward for education and how that will look, whether it's family-centered or community-based or combination. I think, you know, we'll see how that turns out. But I think that we're just moving along this path from schooling to unschooling.
Yeah, and it's a powerful approach, this whole idea, as our kids are getting older, to have all those resources. I think what's scary, though, is when they're little, when they're small children and you're going, what are they never going to learn anything? You know, my little kids, they could play all day long and have no interest. You know, even if I were to sit down and try to read to them, they would just go, no, thanks. And then just go run around and go play. And so that's been kind of my biggest fear, is that we're going, okay, at what point are you going to start to actually get interested in things? But at the same time, they are interested in stuff.
Yeah.
You just have to be, you know, attuned to what it is that they're interested in and then go get that stuff. Or, you know, like I said, we go to the library.
Exactly.
My 4-year-old will pick out all of the Paw Patrol books that he wants, and then he'll sit down and read them. He likes these Captain Awesome books, because I'm like, we're not getting Captain Underpants, but he found Captain Awesome.
Right.
And so he really likes them. And then I can also attest to this idea of a children teaching themselves how to read, was that, you know, every day we sit down and we, before bed, we read from our scriptures, and everybody just gets a verse. And before they know how to read, we read it to them and they repeat it back to us. Well, my now 7-year-old, At one point, I think he was almost 6. I mean, he was still, this is a while ago. And he said, I want to read it myself now. And we said, okay. And he just did. I have never given him any kind of lessons, really. I mean, we just read to them and let them watch, you know, Leapfrog or something like that, you know,
yeah.
And just reading to him. And he just did it. He just started reading. And more recently, you know, I'm trying to see, you know, okay, what kinds of educational type materials is he going to want? Because I've tried to sit down with him with a curriculum and be like, hey, let's do this together and try to make it fun or whatever and appeal to him. But he's just not interested. But we were at a warehouse store and he found this big, huge first grade book that was all Minecraft. And he's never even played Minecraft, but he has gotten the books at the library and he's read all of their books. Yeah. And then he found this curriculum and he'll sit there and he'll work out, he'll write things and he'll work out the math problems and he'll do all the work. That's right. He thinks it's so much fun.
Exactly.
Because it's his interest.
It's his interest. And, you know, kids that have not been schooled don't have this aversion to workbooks that I think a lot of schooled kids have. My kids love workbooks because they know that they can use them however they want, whenever they want. It's not that, you know, every morning we're going to sit down for an hour and do these pages and grade them and so on. But they will, when they're passionate about it, pick up a workbook and fly through and actually get, you know, get it right or ask questions about how, you know, what they don't know. And it becomes a real positive learning experience for them. That's not at all coercive, but that leads to real deep and lasting learning.
Yeah. Because they want to learn it. I mean, how many times have we had something forced down our throats and we don't remember it after the test is over? And I think that it's important to be attuned to what those interests are and hearing them, you know, what they're excited about. The other thing I was going to say is this whole idea of trusting them, you know, that we need to be able to trust our kids. I had an interview previously with Carol Danaher. She was a leader in the Ellen Satter Institute, and that's a nutritional institution. And their whole approach is parents decide when, what, and where kids eat, and then kids decide if they're going to eat it and how much. So it's not even, you know, people go, what, you know, you don't sit there at the dinner table and go finish what's on your plate. They don't want to finish it. They don't want to finish it. And it's that whole idea. This totally relates to education and life is that if you're constantly going, no, you need to finish it. You need to eat this food. You need to finish all your vegetables. They're going to hate vegetables no matter what you do. But if you put it up, spread it all out and say, take as much as you or as little as you want, you're going to go, well, what's that? And you're going to go, oh, it's broccoli. Are you eating broccoli? Yeah, I'm eating broccoli. And then they're going to grab some broccoli and there's no stigma or judgment around whether that's something that's good for them or not. And then have a stack of cookies there and they go, ooh, I love cookies too. And it's like, okay, have a cookie, but you don't need to put out a ton of cookies, right? But you know, it's that idea of not restricting the electronics is that if they have all the other good foods there available, they have all the good other activities and things like that available to them. Right. They're going to reach for those things. They're going to want them. That all totally relates. And I love that.
Right. And I will say, I mean, it's sort of related, I suppose, to the cookies and to the technology too. I mentioned my colleague, Dr. Peter Gray earlier, but he does a lot of his research on, he's an evolutionary psychologist. So he does a lot of his research on the hunter-gatherer tribes. And he looks at hunter-gatherer civilizations and how egalitarian they were and how they treated their children, the children in the tribes, and found that, you know, hunter-gatherer societies, and they're in some cases they're more recently around than, you know, kind of ancient times, but kind of in every tribal civilization, they provided access to the tools of their culture to their children at very young ages. So things like bows and arrows would be available to children at a very young age. But he makes the distinction that poison arrows are kept out of reach. Mm. And so I think the corollary for our modern society, and this is where parents come in, the important role of parents, is that we need to decide what are the poison arrows in our homes, in our culture, for our family. And that's going to be different for every family. So, you know, it's possible that some families might be okay with their kids playing the Fortnite video game, and for other parents, they might not think that that's okay. Mm-hmm. But that might be a poison arrow for them. So I think, you know, there is that piece of it, of kind of parental discretion that goes along with the freedom.
Yeah, because that's part of family culture too, is establishing what your values and your standards and your rules are, so that you all have, you're all on the same page and adapt to what your family values. So that's a good point. Thank you. I love that idea. That's a really great analogy, the poison darts. Yeah. I have to remember that. That's awesome. Awesome. If parents are thinking about homeschooling, what is your advice?
Well, the first thing I would do, I think it's so important to connect with your local community. So I often recommend the first thing you do is Google homeschooling and your local area or your nearest city or however you want to do the search terms. And then find the local community near you. Often now these are online and they're Facebook groups and Yahoo groups and other kinds of networks that then facilitate face-to-face interactions, community activities, meetups, weekly park days, classes, all of those kinds of things. But first start with your local community and see what's available already for you. And then, and you can also check with, you know, often I find that librarians and museum workers can be some of the most helpful for mm-hmm. homeschoolers, because if you think, and particularly for unschoolers, because if you think about it, they share a lot of that same ethos. They love learning for the sake of learning without coercion. You know, to me, libraries and museums are these perfect examples of non-coercive education spaces.
Yeah. Yeah.
But also connect with those kinds of local resources as well. And then books. I know we talked before about, in preparation, of what are some of the books that I would recommend. So I would start with, as I've mentioned, Dr. Peter Gray and his book, Free to Learn, which delves deeper into a lot of these issues. I think anything by John Holt, who was the educator who coined the term unschooling in the late 1970s. He was a pioneer in helping parents to embrace the homeschooling movement. He was really one of the kind of people on the forefront to helping parents remove their children from school in the late 70s, early 1980s, before homeschooling was even legal in many states. So he, in his books, particularly Teach Your Own by John Holt, is incredible. I'd say anything by John Taylor Gatto, in particular his book, Dumbing Us Down, The Hidden Curriculum of Compulsory Schooling, that just came out in its 25th anniversary edition. John Taylor Gatto was the New York State Teacher of the Year and famously quit on the pages of the Wall Street Journal in 1991, saying he couldn't hurt kids anymore. He wanted to move beyond, realizing that often coercive schooling can be damaging to children, and spent kind of the rest of his career writing about it and talking about alternatives to school. So those would be some of the beginning books to read. I would also look at the Teenage Liberation Handbook by Grace Llewellyn, which is geared towards high school kids or adolescents who are frustrated with school, but has some gems in there as well. And then Free Range Learning by Laura Grace Weldon, which is another excellent book. So yeah, connecting with community and reading, and then finding more opportunities throughout the larger kind of community. I would say the Alliance for Self-Directed Education is the organization, the nonprofit organization that I work with. And we have kind of online member forums for families and individuals to connect with. So it's another resource as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Carrie. Where can our guests, my audience, find you and connect with you online?
Right. So my website is wholefamilylearning.com. I'm also on Facebook and Instagram at Whole Family Learning, and on Twitter at Carrie_EDU.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
It's been great to be here, Jody. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. I love getting your feedback. You can like, rate, and share on your favorite broadcasting medium or social media platform. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, and Pinterest at Family Culture Podcast, and on Twitter at _FamilyCulture. Come check out my show notes and resources at homeandfamilyculture.com. Thank you again for listening. Mother Teresa once said, "If you want to change the world, go home and love your family."